Well, boys, looks like you started the fun without me.
You're all sick. Every last one of you.
We're going to need a bigger gun.
What's the matter? You scared of things that go boom, boom, boom?
Give me one goddamn reason why I shouldn't blow your goddamn brains all over that goddamn wall.
My name is Eric, and here for some chaotic good is Michael Kester.
Hello. Welcome.
Michael, how are you doing?
I don't know. We'll find. I'll know the answer to that question in about 50 minutes.
We have a show today that is unlike any other show of the year.
Mm-hmm.
And
I would also argue it's a show unlike any other shows of this kind for the last 10 years.
Yeah, it's probably the most necessary of the year-end show.
Yeah, that's kind of how I'm feeling. I know every year we come around and we're like, this is the one. We figured out how to make this relevant, which apparently wasn't a problem initially. Its relevance was not a factor to us.
All right, I'm going to tell you a couple mandatory things, and then you just give me the whole lowdown.
All right.
There are no spoilers in this episode. You are free of spoilers. Which means if you are on the current year of Double Feature and you decided to peek back and see what the fuck this is, I like to entertain the idea that even though this is not canonically part of the next year, it is the sort of summary paragraph of the whole last year's project.
Mm-hmm.
And what you come to find about Double Feature is, I don't know, maybe you just listen to this episode. Maybe it's fine. Maybe you don't need that whole year.
Mm-hmm.
We probably said something stupid in it anyways. So
this is the spark notes. Yeah.
Yeah, just skip it. We left a lot of things kind of open in the air to consider and meditate on like we do.
Yep.
And we'd like to grab a couple of those things and anchor them down on the show. So having said that, the other thing is patreon.com/doublefeature. If you're hearing this right now, now is the fucking time to get on there and help us pick out the movies for the next year of the show. So if you plan to sign up and come week by week onto the next sort of, we've taken all the words, adventure, journey, we've used all these. The next year of programming, if you want to be with us for it, it's patreon.com/doublefeature. So that's it. What is this show?
This is the show where we come on here and pretend we knew what the fuck we were doing for the last calendar year of Double Feature and try and basically... We're given 52 points on a graph, and we just pretend that they're all connected after the fact. We figure that out now. That's what we figure out now. And
yeah.
I'll be honest, it's more difficult this year than in previous years because I feel like looking at the list in front of me, it doesn't...
It's kind of a schism in our episodes.
Yeah. In previous years, you just kind of go like... Show, kids find a body, show, kids find a body. Uh-huh. And you realize that there's a line of kids finding a body. And you go, this is the year where the kids found the body. This year, I'm looking at this graph and there's distinctly sort of two versions of the year. It's the same as there's two versions of the planet. There's the planet pre-pandemic and the planet... post-pandemic with this also, and I'll be, I know exactly where it is. I'm staring at it. There's also a point where it's like, you know what, when you look at the year, the calendar, there's BCE and AD.
Yeah. My calendars often come with BCE and AD.
Yeah. And
it's
then
like
there's
a fucking phone book.
And then there's the eponymous year zero where it's like, I don't, that could both be either or neither. And there's a year zero on this year of the show as well. There's a single episode. The episodes around it are hazy, but there's a single episode on this that I'm just like, I barely remember it. I was in a different body. It neither feels like it was pre or post pandemic. It was in the actual crux of the planet discovering that it was about to change forever. And that's when we did Sweeney Todd and Cold Fish.
I've been waiting this whole time to say, yes, it did. And it's just become less and less funny.
Sorry.
You couldn't have given me one breath in there. Holding on to jokes that nobody gets anyways. It's a Nine Inch Nails thing. All right, well, that's a good place to start. I'm going to do everybody a favor and sort of give up our notes on this one so that you can try to follow along, because I know there's no fucking transitions and these are just like whiplash episodes.
Yeah.
So we need to talk about the change in the state of the world. I know you have some concerns around watching a film and it having been pretty hard. I want to revisit that. We looked at virtual cinema this year. And I want to take another look back at how, there's a bullet point, virtual cinema, we'll get into it. Our journey, the cinematographer and writer journey, we didn't examine the results yet. We got to do that. Killapaloozas this year, couple of the themes of the year. Well, I'll just tell you what they were right now, the subtitled films and why the fuck hasn't anyone seen this. There are the, there's the accidental themes of the year. If they come up, they come up, so be it. I want to talk about the pairs that were the best pairs.
Yep.
And actually, let's move this on the outline in real time. I want to talk about the worst pairs first.
Sure.
The just what the fuck were we doing pairs of the show.
And then there's the other set of pairs. The pairs that would have been different had we done them in the latter half of the year.
It's my very next thing on the outline. You know, it's almost as if I should have shared this with you. I don't know. I like to keep where we're going a secret from you.
To anybody listening, to be fair, he actually offered to share it with me. And I said something along the lines of, I don't give a fuck. It doesn't matter, without looking up from my phone. That was that conversation.
And finally, I want to talk about spiritual trilogies. That seems like a weird place to put that. And you said you didn't care about the order of any of this. So let me hit you first. You were talking about COVID and how it changed watching films.
Yes.
And I feel like the big question as a film audience member right now in the world is, it's still fucking weird. And I just want to know how you're doing.
So this can actually start in a place. This can start where many things started, where many of the world's problems started, on Facebook.
Ah, the white supremacist website. the funder, a website for everybody who wants to help fund the president's reelection. Facebook.com.
When you posted,
don't follow that statement up with me being on Facebook. No, we're supposed to pretend when I rally against these things that I'm better than using them, not that I still participate. That's sort of
on a social media platform. You questioned people's comfort level of going back to the movie theater. And I think that's where I kind of want to start with this, because I think it'll tie into the virtual cinema aspect of things too. And the joke for many weeks when that happened, I don't know exactly fucking when, but the jokes for many weeks was that I was basically living on that thread, going back every day or so and just being like, just for the record, want to say I would still definitely go to the movie theater.
All right.
I mean,
mine changes every day. That's where my head is.
Right. Well, I'm in Texas, which meant one thing then and means another thing now, you know?
Can we pause on that point for a second?
Yeah.
Because as you sort of discussed the thing that you're having trouble with both on and off the show, a big part of it, talked about it on those episodes, is the sort of concern where we are in the world moves so fast that an episode might not be relevant.
Yep.
And I think it's very funny that even the episodes, even if the centerpiece of an episode was that one of us was out of a lockdown and the other state, you know, was in it.
Yeah.
The world just doesn't give a fuck about any of our programming. It's like Texas. Maybe you go back in lockdown. I don't give a fuck. You just do whatever.
Right.
We have we cannot predict anything about the world. It is pointless.
And that's the thing is. The reality to our global listeners and to our people who've successfully managed to keep their head partially buried in the sand with all this is that Texas is surging, which is, you know, the thing that we say offhandedly when it means that a lot of people are about to die very quickly. And, you know, it's the 1-2 punch. It's a Texas is a conservative state famously, and its leadership is famously conservative right now.
Mm-hmm.
In so much that we are spiking to over 4,000 new cases a day with moderate testing at best, and there nothing is closing. Nothing, masks are not even mandatory.
Has that made it easier for you to watch these films now that, because I know a big concern of yours when we first started was sort of like, look at all these people in a room. Nobody's wearing a mask. People are touching hands.
In some ways, yeah, actually. That has sort of lifted to a certain degree, but it hasn't helped with this underlying thing, which is that I feel gaslighted by the society around me because I feel like I'm the crazy one who's afraid of catching and spreading a pandemic.
Yeah.
Because everybody else is out there fucking going to bars. I mean, flat out, that's where people can go to bars. People can eat indoors in restaurants. You know, there's some fucking really shitty foamy hand sanitizer inside of the door of every fucking place you go. But that's it, man. That's the difference. So to go back to your page on that white supremacy site.
Excuse me, this was friendproject.net where I posted that, just to be clear. Okay.
I
was on Ello when I...
Yeah, there we go.
Are you wondering how many alternative social networks I know? Because you'll be impressed with the answer.
I'm officially at the point where if Draft House were to reopen tomorrow, I don't know if I'd be comfortable. We're 3 times as likely to catch the virus now in Austin than we were in March. So it's just that much worse, which scares the shit out of me because I'm sitting here looking at cinemas. Not literally. Well, a little bit literally, but mostly theoretically. I don't just go and longingly stare at these empty monolithic buildings so much. But what will that ever be?
Imagine for a second that you are not worried just about going to Draft House. Another theme, by the way, unofficial IRL theater of double feature. Draft House.
Sure.
We've all decided to, especially now when AMC is like, fuck you. That's the current
right. Zeitgeist. Yeah.
But imagine that you didn't just have to consider, well, where will I go to Draft House? But that you were perhaps currently in the middle of yet another chapter of virtual cinema at, I don't know, let's say a Marché de Film, trying to sell your fucking projects to investors when no one at this film market knows if movie theaters will even exist or what states or countries will be able to film in ever again.
Or is even actually at that film market.
Yeah. Let's talk about virtual cinema for a second.
Yeah. I have come to a conclusion on my feelings on virtual cinema, I'll give you some. I hate it. I don't like it.
We did South by Southwest.
Yeah.
That was our big look at it on the show. We were paying attention to our friends Draft House.
We did the Alamo On Demand. We did the Kino Lorber picks.
Yeah. So we were really looking at those. And then, of course, the Shock of the Future and the feeling when no GF, TFW no GF.
Yeah. I mean, we even did the more global at-home $20 rental thing when we did The Hunt and Emma.
So your feeling is, fuck this court. I hate it.
Yeah. Yeah, it's just not my vibe, man.
What about it? I mean, look, I know, but let's take a stop down here. What about it is falling short for you?
I feel like it literally and theoretically belittles the art of the piece. There's so much more to movies than your couch and the pause button and taking a leak. And, you know, the thing that's coming up and the thing that a lot of people said would define the future of cinema is Tenet.
Mm-hmm.
Tenet, flat out, this is a Christopher Nolan movie. Tenet will not exist in, try to imagine only seeing a Chris Nolan movie on your home screen and imagining to yourself exists in the same place in my mind as Inception.
Mm-hmm.
It just won't. I mean, There is this psychological barrier that I don't think people realize when you watch a movie at home, that you just, the film literally cannot carry the gravitas that it can in the theater. Except, and I think this will sort of, man, you give me a fucking bullet points, man, I got you. Except I honestly think when a movie has subtitles.
I told you I was rejecting the subtitle bullet point. Get the fuck out of here, subtitle. Don't attract attention to the fact that every third movie on the show is now subtitled.
But that's the thing is, look at the year, look when that mm-hmm. started, man. Mm-hmm. Like,
yeah.
La Lalande was early, but I mean, okay, so Big Man Japan, the Three Colors stuff, these are early, but we didn't really start doing essentially weekly subs until...
Weekly subs is what we do on your OnlyFans, not on the Patreon. Right,
sorry. April.
Yeah.
Zombie Child.
Yeah, and then we started hitting a lot of them.
Yeah, then it was every week, man.
Look, I have a little bit of good news on this, but it does keep just being extremely weird. I'm still optimistic. Cinemas reopen, people go, we get through all this, but there's no point in trying to predict the future, as I said before. Here's what I will tell you. At the time we're recording this, I am in the middle of the Cannes Film Festival.
Mm-hmm.
And this is, you know, one of the largest film festivals of the year. It's also a market, so people get their projects and so forth. I don't know what they get done, taken care of, sold, bought.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody really knows what we're doing there this year. It's some film business happens. So the Cannes Film Festival also has a huge like red carpet component. And there's a lot of mainstream sort of Access Hollywood type coverage of this. I want to say from the logistical standpoint, from the infrastructure, all this stuff that usually falls short in the festival experience, see Amazon's, for instance, is fantastic here. It's really good. It's easy to find the catalog of films. There's a ton of stuff to watch. It encourages, because of the business side of it, to meet up with other people, to talk to them. And it also takes a lot of the baggage of that fest out of it. So for everything you can't get, what you can get is, what you do get out of it is people aren't talking to each other like, oh, you've never been here before. You don't know how this goes. Let me tell you how the old guard does this.
Mm-hmm.
Because everybody's just confused and doesn't know what to do. And it's this great equalizer where all the like old money people have to figure out how email works.
Mm-hmm.
So that's quite exciting. Oddly, the strangest thing about it, oh, and also the sort of sessions and Q&A and all of that is presented more like at a film fest where, look, here's the main theater and this is what's on at 9 o'clock and here's what's on at 1 o'clock. It's not go in and click this. It's more Shudder TV style. You're going to watch this when it's supposed to play, which is cool. And then people can talk about it. All of that's great except for two things. One, no one went or is going. You can see in their live stream how many people are watching, and it's like 40 or 50. It's not even a Tulsa rally full of people.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, just draw that mark in the calendar there. It's the day of the episode. And then the other thing is like, okay, so you put in your time zone when you start, and then it gives you your local time zone of doing the thing. Except the world still operates the way a spinning pebble in space operates, which means I want to catch this genre thing today, and that means I actually want to catch tomorrow's genre thing today at like 1 a.m. I want to do the morning brunch. I have to do that at 4 a.m. I have to, you know, you're on French time.
Yeah.
So it's still fucking weird and non-optimal, but I do, it's the first time I've started to see, oh, you know, if we get fests operational again and then we add some of this stuff, it makes it more accessible for people. It takes away some of just the disgusting
right
old guard stuff about the industry, which is pretty cool. I also want to go back to theaters, man. I don't know. Nothing like watching a Killapalooza at the... There's my attempt at it.
Nice. Yeah, that was okay.
You remember when we saw Four Species films at the...
No, I don't.
Drive-in or
don't
the,
remember. Yeah, the Killapalooza... We did... It's funny, man. The Killapaloozas this year, we did two. And in my mind, if I hadn't seen this calendar in front of me and you said, what were the Killapaloozas we did this year? I swear to God, I would have just been like, I don't know, like The Grudge and The Ring.
No, I would have said Ginger Snaps.
Uh-huh.
That would have been mine.
Looking at them, I know we did Species. I don't remember doing it, flat out. Those movies, no, I mean, you know, so much has happened since then, but also it's just probably, maybe I shouldn't say this, but who fucking cares? Probably not my favorite of the Killapaloozas, and maybe it's not four movies that I think even have a whole lot to say different than each other.
It's also weird that, you know, what I do remember about that, I'm so excited, by the way, to remember something when you don't.
Yeah.
This is a moment I've waited maybe my whole life for, if I could remember if I've been waiting my whole life for. What I remember is we were sort of celebrating this culture of smut you watch on TV at 2 a.m.
Yeah, for sure.
And now we don't care about that. We want to go back to movie theaters. We're like, get things off of TV at 4 a.m.
Yep.
Get them off of MacBook screens at 4 a.m.
Mm-hmm.
Just, I want to go back to the theater. So I don't know if I'd go as far as to say that's what cast it out of your mind. But yeah, that's immediately what I remembered about that. And I could not get myself excited in this moment right now to talk about it. It's a little bit different story with I Know What You Did Last Summer. But, you know, it's a three-film Killapalooza.
Listen, I Know What You Did Last Summer was probably like cruising until two episodes ago to be one I remembered. But it is no longer the Sarah Michelle Gellar movie that I will recall.
Yeah, I had to explain the plot of that movie to somebody a couple weeks ago, and I was so glad we did that episode, but I still was not able to coherently put it together. It's a weird year for Killapaloozas. I preferred when we had a Ginger Snaps here or there, but look, we're out of franchises.
Yep,
we got to find two more for next year. Double feature show at iCloud.com.
40 Killapaloozas.
No, I don't know what we're going to do. I don't, you know, there are a couple franchises that have three installments, though, if we are willing to go there. I mean,
listen, once Dead by Daylight adds a franchise, it's canonically a horror classic.
All right. So, well, one more Silent Hill. It's Silent Hill 1, Silent Hill 2, and then Michael just playing Dead by Daylight on a fucking Twitch stream for an hour and a half, and that's the Killapaloozas. While I'm staring at our website, the David Lynch weather reports came back during quarantine, and it just felt like we had to tell people on the show that.
Yeah.
There's no bullet here. I just saw his nice little picture over there, and I thought,
I mean, the bullet is we miss the David Lynch at the 600 mark. That's a bullet.
Well, it wasn't calling to us the same way it usually is when we're doing the schedule and it's just sort of, oh man, it's coming up. What are we going to do? There's these obvious choices.
What's left? Rabbits?
All right. Let's talk about the journey.
The big journey.
Pose the question of the journey to me.
On the ship that is a film, when the captain is away, does the cinematographer or the writer steer the ship?
I have explained to so many people in my life when they're like, oh, what's double feature? I'm like, well, we pair two movies, but sometimes it gets really complicated. And they're like, well, what do you mean? And I have come up with so many ways. And I think the one thing that I learned for sure doing these episodes is that you and I can pitch this specific journey in about 10,000 different metaphors. When you're painting a painting, who has the firmest grasp on the paintbrush? You know, there's just, it's every time I do it, there's a new thing. But yeah, look, we consider movies on the show. We talk a lot about the directors. Film is a collaboration. I believe in film as the director's vision, but we thought, what's the writer have to say about that? What's the cinematographer have to say about that? We wanted to look at guiding hands outside of the director and see who had an influence. Now, we exhaustively covered so much of that material when we actually did it episode per episode and really just pounded it into the ground. I feel like journey-wise, this has been one of my favorites for just like the idea was clear and we just exhausted the fuck out of it. We got so many different examples. We got to get weird with it.
Mm-hmm.
We got to kind of arrive at an answer that we didn't expect a little early and then sort of like try to fuck with our response a little. But what we didn't do is answer the fucking question. So, you know, let's start with our writer here. We saw these David Mamet films. Mm-hmm. We wanted to know if we could detect his signature through the movies, whether he's directing, not directing. It's somebody else. It's a visionary. It's someone you've never heard of. It's a play adapted from a fucking who knows.
Right.
Do you think you see the Mamet?
Yes.
Do you think you see the Mamet more than the director?
In this case, yeah. Yeah, definitely. Except in Red Belt. In Red Belt, I see the director and the writer equally.
Yeah, well, that's a joke for people who listen to that show. You know, I promised them they wouldn't have to go back and listen, and there you go. Yeah, I think because we were looking for Mamet there, it was pretty easy to go, let's look at the stories of Mamet.
Yeah.
And, you know, we do see this in some places. Look at, say, the Harry Potter films. Never covered them on the show, but a lot of people have seen them. Most of them have different directors. But you're going to see the Harry Potter films, not Alfonso Cuarón's Harry Potter film.
Right.
Depending on who you are and what year of the show this is.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But you know what I'm saying. So, you know, when you really create a space in your mind to consider a thing in a certain light, sometimes I think that helps. I think it helped with Mamet. I think if we had, you know, looked at some of these other directors and Mamet things, I mean, we've already kind of answered that part of the question.
I wish we hadn't done the first episode of this first. I wish we had approached it differently because I would have loved to do, because the first pair we did was The Untouchables and The Lady Killers,
mm-hmm.
where our idea was let's take directors we know and try to ignore them. You know, basically
we
noise
sort of did
cancel
a hard one first.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We were trying to noise cancel the familiar sounds and see what was left. We should have done that later because I'm looking at The Untouchables and I definitely see that as a Mamet movie. That's De Palma, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't see it as a Brian De Palma movie. And I feel like I would have liked to have a little bit more Mamet under my belt to see if I could equalize it. But honestly, that looks like a David Mamet movie to me. Whereas The Lady Killers is also interesting because I would say The Lady Killers doesn't look that much like a Coen Brothers movie. However, from a cinematographical standpoint, it doesn't matter because Deakins did all of them. So it looks as much, you know what I mean? I can't say Deakins made The Lady Killers unique because he didn't necessarily have any more or less to do with that than any other Coen movie.
You know, The Untouchables looking like a Mamet movie does answer the question for me because I think I have enough of a sense of film and how things are perceived that, you know, when we're looking at, say we're looking at Vanya, I mean, I could really do a director-specific look there.
Mm-hmm.
But when we're looking at The Untouchables, people look at The Untouchables and they think De Palma. I know people think that. So the fact I'm able to go, Untouchables, that's that David Mamet movie, that tells me that I have conditioned myself to think that way.
Yep.
But throw all the results out the fucking window, man, because that didn't work for Roger Deakins for me.
Not even close. Yeah.
Crazy, no. Right?
And to be fair, you know, Roger Deakins was actually an easier study because if you're looking at their overall body of work, Deakins is basically just like a popcorn fest and you get to choose all this fun shit.
Mm-hmm.
And Mamet is basically like homework or harder.
Yeah.
And so Deakins actually sort of made it, I thought Deakins would be easier because we were able to look at what I consider to be a way more variant scope of work, tie in other directors, jump from genre to genre. And at the end of the day, all I can tell you is that all the movies look really good. the cinematography is super on point, drives the story, makes the movie impactful. He does tricks. He doesn't do tricks.
Mm-hmm.
And all in all, I just don't, I think, and we touched on this, you brought this up. I'm not going to even claim any credit. You brought this up, I think, around The Village or Doubt. And you said that maybe you can't see Deakins and that is why he's so good.
Yeah, well, it's often said about cinematographers, but, you know, we still want to call it out to see if it's bullshit.
Mm-hmm.
People say that they're trying to put forward the director's vision. But when you control so much of the frame, I don't know, man. I have a hard time believing that you don't see a signature there.
Sure.
But we examined one of the best working cinematographers today and perhaps of all time. And we found that I believe him.
Sure.
I believe when he says I show up and try to make the director's vision happen. Because I see, you know, the other thing about these movies is you look at a lot of them and, you know, Blade Runner, The Village, these are, especially the last two,
mm-hmm.
these feel so specifically like the boldest version of that director's work that I can think of.
I mean, yeah, it's not to just live in fucking camera puns, but the absolute most crystal clear version of a vision comes through on these movies.
Mm-hmm.
The vision is different. The ideas are different. The genre and the storytelling is incredibly variant, but the one thing that doesn't change is that it is incredibly clear. And I don't mean, hey, good gate. I mean, like, the intention is absolutely definitive in the execution. And I think that that, while we're just arbitrarily using metaphors, with David Mamet, I would say that he is the black ground pepper. And Deakins is the salt, because David Mamet, you put it on there, you go, ooh, I taste the Mamet. But
ooh, I taste the Mamet. We could have just started with that and saved everyone 10 minutes.
When you put the Deakins in there, you go, I don't necessarily taste it, but I can definitely tell you that if it wasn't there, I would notice something was missing.
Cinematographers are such a weird thing, and I feel like I was cagey on that episode. And I regret being cagey and overly diplomatic in a lot of these episodes. That's a little personal project for next year on the show.
Yeah, I'm getting over that real quick. I got that Texas heartbeat man. Yeah. I don't give a fuck.
I know. I'm like watching videos of Chicago on fire.
Yeah.
I'm like, this, restore this to my life.
Yeah.
I've worked with cinematographers before who were very concerned with making it look like their other work, and they spoke the specific talk. They're here for your vision. What's your vision? And then the second you open your mouth, they're like, yeah, but I usually do this kind of thing. So let's do this. And it fucking sucks. And I hate it. And also cinematographers, like everybody on set, you know, other departments make fun of other departments. And, you know, every department would tell you some other department is like notoriously bad. But fuck, man, as a director and as a producer, cinematographers can be such a pain in the ass.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, when they're really good, rightfully so, like that's sort of the worst part of it. Maybe that's me being diplomatic again. Fuck the cinematographers who are a pain in the ass. They should be team players like everybody else on a set. So, you know, I was really curious about this because Roger Deakins says that, like everybody says it. But when you look at Deakins' work, he, you know, there are also incredible cinematographers I've worked with that not just for the purpose of enjoying the director's vision or feeling like it's the right thing to do, just selfishly, they enjoy trying different things. They enjoy that their work looks wildly different.
Mm-hmm.
Scope is very important to them. The idea that they can try this, they can do this, you know, it helps them get work. Artistically, I think that's just another very satisfying thing. But when you really read what Deakins has written or listen to him speak, he understands the vision of every film that he worked on, even when some of them, I'm not sure the directors understood the fucking vision.
Right.
And that's pretty amazing. You know, the fucking proof is in the pudding on that. Like you just, if he understands it that deeply and you can't see him in it, there's really only one conclusion you know, I can reach.
Mm-hmm.
And so I actually think it's kind of cool that we can see the writer in this particular one case study. Mm-hmm. And we can't see the cinematographer.
And I think it's interesting because it sort of doesn't answer the question, especially when you use the boat metaphor, because, or the paintbrush, whatever fucking metaphor we're talking about, the writer...
You have enough people in the kitchen and they're all stirring the...
The writer takes the wheel if the director isn't there. The cinematographer stays the course.
Which is also like, look, I could do this with you all day, but isn't that also funny considering the cinematographer is always on set
yeah.
and the writer is almost never on set?
Right. So next time, next year, I think we're just going to continue a similar journey. We'll do five craft services movies and five of the same key grip.
Oh my God.
And see who is steering the ship.
What we'll find is that Alec Baldwin just got fatter on every movie. all right. This bullet point says make jokes about Alec Baldwin for
good.
10 minutes.
Yeah.
I don't.
Alec Baldwin is really, I feel like we're really honing the Baldwin metaphor in Double Feature.
Except the more episodes we do, the more nobody gets it.
I mean, but that's the thing is I think we're almost about to transcend the Glengarry Glen Ross of it. And it's just going to become its own mimetic piece of trash. Welcome to Double Feature.
Hey, let's look at some other pieces of trash. What about the what the fuck? I'm getting so good at these transitions. I want you to know I saved all my transition game yeah. for this last episode.
Good. Now this is fire.
What the fuck pairs? We tried so hard to come up with good pairs, but the world was very cruel this year of the show.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
maybe more than, I don't know, the last 5 years or more of the show, we did not pre-plan this year.
Right.
To nearly yeah. the extent.
Much to many people's chagrin.
Yeah, there's a lot of reasons for that. I don't know how important they are. Part of it was we were just trying to get this fucking Patreon funded every week for like months and months and months going, what the fuck, and not knowing what the future holds.
Mm-hmm.
I think both of our own lives were a bit like that. And then, of course, the global fucking pandemic.
Yeah, I mean, I can tell you, I'm looking at this list. I can tell you just looking at these, there's a couple right now that I'm just like, what the fuck was that?
Yeah, I didn't very well complete the thought there, but I guess what I was getting at is we scrambled on some, or we sort of knew in a haze at midnight,
two nights earlier what we were doing
and then forgot.
Part of this comes from us not necessarily knowing a movie when we are maybe asked to do it,
mm-hmm.
which I think is the case with This Must Be the Place and Get Carter, because I think Get Carter is a really strong movie, but I don't really know why we put fucking... Robert Smith Penn in the movie
yeah.
next to it. The other one, and this is on me because I was really pushing for this and I thought it was a really good idea. I don't necessarily know if, I'll be honest, I don't necessarily know if it was a bad pair or if I just feel like we could have done a better job. But the Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure and Pauly Shore's Dead Show, the theme is actually really on point, dude. Like we knew what we wanted to talk about, but I think the reality is this is sort of like what I'm saying. I feel like Bill and Ted were like, boom, Bill and Ted, we get it.
Yeah.
And I think Pauly Shore's Dead threw us a curveball because it was like kind of offensive and like we weren't actually like super crazy about supporting it.
Yeah.
And so I think that it basically took us out at the knees because we were like, Pauly Shore old, Bill and Ted is like young Pauly Shore. This will be sort of like a look what happens when 90s comedy grows up. But then Pauly Shore was just sort of a problem. And we had to kind of go, okay, so like we wanted to talk about the tubular, but instead we have to talk about like what happens when you age out of being appropriate.
Yeah, well, I also think we were circling a theme that we just didn't have yet. I mean, yeah, I kind of take this on, but let's really talk about the meat of this here. You were circling a theme. You were interested in a thing, and you were kind of having trouble putting your finger on it. I don't feel bad saying that because I think when we did 599, which was Space Jam and the World's End, we nailed it. But that was kind of the beginning, you know, just 5 or 6 episodes prior. You're sort of looking at the new Bill and Ted stuff happening. You're wondering about this older culture, this nostalgia. And really, we needed a show for you to vent frustrations about nostalgia cinema and cashing in on that. And Bill and Ted, you know, the joke of the Bill and Ted show was kind of the vent of your frustrations, and then we didn't really get to do it there. So when we did the Space Jam World's End show, I mean, if you go back and listen to that show, it was funny mixing it because it starts as a Space Jam show and then goes into like Michael has a fucking meltdown about nostalgia. Just like at some point, it's just like this, we need to stop doing this. What is wrong with people? And I'm there kind of like, haha, you guys seen the Space Jam website? Anyways, I'll let you go. Yeah, so I feel like, you know, you thinking we need Tubular Joke, the pair.
Yeah.
Was like secretly you venting this chip on your shoulder.
Uh-huh.
And then you're like, no, let's have the chip on the shoulder be the theme of the episode.
Yeah.
And we lean, and you know, World's End was such a good, I know this is kind of like pat yourself on the back double feature.
But it was so bad, but like in the same way, it being bad made it so good. I just, my biggest flaw is that I care too much, man, that I work too hard sometimes.
I don't think the Space Jam World's End show was bad. I think the Bill and Ted show was bad. And I think the Space Jam World's End show was the kind of incredible show that we needed a whole show's worth of practice to get to.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know that the Space Jam show was much more than Michael rails against Space Jam, sort of. But, you know, the World's End was still just such a kind of clever look at, like, aging through stuff you're holding. Whatever. We don't need to redo that show. But I thought it was fucking great. I thought it was great, Michael. But we're trying to find some bad ones. I'll give you a couple what the fuck ones. Oh, man. Eden Lake and The Wicker Man.
Good movies don't go good together.
I think Eric was stressed and trying to have a good time that week. And I also think I assumed we were doing Lake Mungo in The Wicker Man. And I got my legs crossed and then tried to just pretend that it worked. God, that was really one of my big ones. I'm looking over this and, you know, I agree with you on some. And then on others, I mean, I just see, don't hate me, but I see a lot of double features that I really like.
There's a bunch of good ones.
I think they were great.
Before we get to the good ones,
please.
We can sort of like segue out and back into this. I'll tell you, there are three pairs on here that from a double feature standpoint are fucking terrible.
You want to do this now, huh?
I just think they're really bad pairs.
Mm-hmm.
When we decided to do the Gates of Hell trilogy next to the Three Colors trilogy.
Let me just copy and paste this bullet up here.
Garbage pairing.
Uh-huh.
Terrible pairs. You know, the whole idea, and this is sort of the thing about a spiritual trilogy, is we went, oh no, they're like spiritual trilogies. Let's see what that looks like. And then we paired these two fucking crazy different things that have their own shit to say. Not even together, right?
Yeah.
We at no point in time could be like, you know, The Beyond was actually really similar to Three Colors Red in that.
Not even a little bit ever.
Yeah, that's impossible. The only fucking through line we ever managed was on the last of the three where I went, you know, they died on the same day. And we went, whoa, mind blown.
Yeah.
But I do feel like I learned something about the idea of a spiritual trilogy, which is kind of to say, shut the fuck up. Just make three movies.
We did kind of find that your take by the end of Three Colors was, look how much of a fucking trilogy this is.
Yeah.
There's no spiritual. This is just a trilogy that's like a little different, but it's better planned.
Yeah.
The Bill and Ted trilogy will not look as coherent as the fucking Colors trilogy. It's crazy.
You know what would have been really good in hindsight would have been that fucking random Shyamalan trilogy with the Three Colors trilogy. Because it didn't know it was a trilogy until halfway through its own trilogy.
Yeah, that is kind of funny. I mean, I think the nature of that episode is we couldn't have learned what we learned on it without being terrible of those three episodes.
Sure.
Because we were kind of going like, I actually think, look, I'm sorry I'm doing this. This is really genuinely how I feel. Maybe because it's pitches all week and I'm just turning lemons into lemonade everywhere I go. But it's better than we thought it was going to be because what we did, being honest, was just put three spiritual trilogy movies together at random, two different people whose movies we wanted to watch. What we found is one was an example of a poor execution of that, and one was an example of a great execution of that. Now, does that make three good individual pairs? It does not. But the bar for what I hope to accomplish with that little run of episodes was even lower than what we actually found. We did learn something in the end, which was sort of like, you got to do a little more than make the same movie three times and be like, I don't know. You noticed that too? It's a trilogy. There, I fixed it. So I don't mind. I don't mind the shows, Michael. I think they're fine. I'll give you one of my big what the fuck-ish shows, though, and this can lead into one of our last little talking points here. But if ever there was an episode on the show that would look weirder after the red line, the COVID pandemic line in our schedule, would it not have been Boca and the fucking Signal?
Right?
That's the Contagion show right there. That's when that should have landed.
Yep.
And I don't think it's bad it landed where it did. And again, silver lining time, I think it's great because then we get the point of comparison. But there's a lot of these, and I know a question that you wanted to discuss, so maybe we do that here and then we leave on the good pairs. Which pairs from the first half of the year would have been a completely different show if done in the second half of the year after lockdown started?
I agree with that choice. My pick for this is Assassination Nation and Hail Satan, but not for the pandemic thing, for the protest thing. That pair at the time seemed like we were intentionally trying to ruffle feathers and intentionally going, yeah, it's a little bit of civil unrest, you little complacent fucks.
Yeah. We were basically over there dropping off crates of bricks, being like, yeah, oh, I'll just
that's what that was. That's what that was. Yeah, I think Assassination Nation and Hail Satan at down there at episode 600, right there at the beginning of the year, was a cute dog whistle. And I think 4 months later, it's a fucking bullhorn, you know?
Yeah, well, because honestly, what that show was for us is just feeling like, God, it's been terrible for so long. Is no one going to do anything? Are we really over trying to change the world and being frustrated?
Yep.
And then we started trying to change the world again, which is fucking rad.
We also lucked out and did blind spotting on March 5th.
Yeah, I mean, I almost regret that, though.
You think that would have been better later?
I don't know. You know, we had the Sorry to Bother You show, and it almost seemed like a step two. Because it was a show about capitalism in the moment, whereas blind spotting was sort of the like required reading type stuff people wanted to do at that moment.
Yeah, the voice of blind spotting just seems like Bob Dylan in the We Are the World of the conversation. You know what I mean?
Wow. Wow. I feel like it's not going to get any kinder to the film the more we unpack that, so I don't want to. I love blind spotting. I don't know what your problem is.
No, I do. I think it's incredible. I think blind spotting...
It's one of my favorite of the year.
I know, that pair was great. I just think blind spotting... I think blind spotting was saying what everybody started repeating. You know what I mean?
Oh, sure.
And to go and do blind spotting when everybody's in the streets, essentially just doing the rap at the end of blind spotting.
Yeah.
And you just watch blind spotting and be like, right, I have seen the news. Thank you.
Yeah.
It just wouldn't have
the same. I also follow people on Instagram.
Right. Exactly. It just wouldn't have the same punch.
I've read all of these PDFs. Thank you.
It wouldn't have the same punch as it did doing it earlier. I'm not trying to undercut the movie. I think it's fucking incredible. I think David Diggs he's one of my favorite new talents.
Yeah.
But it's just like, at this point, we get it. And at that point, it was revolutionary, you know?
Yeah, totally.
It's not any less poignant, but we get it now.
Yeah.
The cops that killed Breonna Taylor are still not arrested, right? That's fucking blind spotting.
Maybe the one time we've ever been able to talk about a bit of news that I just have no confidence will change. How about that?
Yeah, right? Like, yeah, sure.
Well, we don't know what the world holds, but we do know one thing. No one has arrested the cops that killed Breonna Taylor. That's the one thing in life we can fucking be sure of. Man, just when I was all happy about us changing the world, you got to bring that up. Why do you got
to
do that?
I'm sorry. I'm just trying to be realistic here.
Jesus, just the worst. Give me another pair. I'm mad now.
I feel like we do this every year, but it's definitely goes without saying that the Well, so not the Spider Southland Tales episode was good. It was like a nice palate cleanser, but I still think the Sorry to Bother You Bulworth show was actually the year end and was possibly the greatest pair of the year. However, it's always easy to say that. I now know this. It's always easy to say that because it's the freshest one. And so it hasn't necessarily aged and I don't get to look at it objectively the way I can look at like another super good pair back here. Like, honestly, Moneyball and Betting on Zero,
still
kind
funny.
Of a great pair.
Still even funnier with Distance, really.
Yeah, and I think Force Majeure and Killing of a Sacred Deer.
Yeah.
Actually, you know what? That whole, there's a block of four here. Was this a whole month? Yeah, just go back.
The good month
go back to Double Feature. Go back to January of this year of Double Feature, January 16th. You know, today would be, if you want to go back to January of Double Feature all the way to February 6th, it would be a really good time to arrest the cops who killed Breonna Taylor.
I want to thank Abbott of Unreason, Ben Ecker, Brett Hayton, Charles Crawford, John Ross Muller, and Tom Leonard. They are the executive producers of the show. Patreon.com/double feature. We're doing weird movies to start out the year. And we just wanted to continue the 1 year long tradition of doing things that we just don't do.
That's right. We're going to do Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse. And then we're going to pair that with a Netflix special.
Feature length Netflix special.
If you just go on Netflix and you look up Bandersnatch, that's how you'll find it. It's a film, but it is part of the Black Mirror universe.
I don't even know what to say about those. I can only hope that that changes before next time on Double Feature.
Watch more fucking film.
Bye.
This program is a proud member of the Battleship Pretension Fleet.